From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Justice of the Peace did kind of a conglomeration of three or four different kinds of ceremonies that my partner had put together. And at the end, we were joined.
The first lesbian couple joins in civil union in the United States. Tensions flare in the north of Ireland. Pro-British militants are threatening more violence after 4 days of widespread attacks as they attempt to march through a Catholic neighborhood. And a Connecticut newspaper apologizes for profiting from slave ads. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An oil barge spilled more than 9,000 gallons of its cargo into an ecologically sensitive area of Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island yesterday, raising concerns about damage to shorebirds and fragile habitats. The Coast Guard believes the spill was caused when the barge heading to a power plant in Somerset, Massachusetts, collided with the tugboat that was towing it. The 460-foot barge was carrying more than 10 million gallons of oil. It was ruptured about 2 miles from Prudence Island, home to the Narragansett Bay Estuarine Sanctuary. It's being called Japan's biggest case of food poisoning in decades. Health officials say more than 11,000 people in western Japan have been sickened by tainted milk. The outbreak has been traced to a milk plant. Officials blame bacteria allowed to accumulate in a production line valve. The plant has been shut down, and police have begun investigating the possibility of criminal negligence in the case. The UN Security Council imposed a diamond ban yesterday on Sierra Leone's rebels in a bid to strangle their ability to finance a civil war that's already cost the lives of tens of thousands of people. The embargo is for an initial 18 months. The council could decide to extend it if the government hasn't reasserted its authority over Sierra Leone's diamond mines, 90% of which remain in rebel hands. Mali abstained from the vote, saying it opposed the resolution's reference to illegal diamonds being shipped through Liberia. But Sierra Leone's UN ambassador, Ibrahim Kamara, held the council's willingness to name names and to acknowledge that Sierra Leone's war isn't about ideology or tribal differences, but rather about diamonds and people trying to make illegal profit off them. This news from Chicago. Civil rights workers who apply for jobs to test whether employers discriminate against minorities in hiring may sue those who show bias. This according to an appeals court. The 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday overturned a lower court decision that threw out such a lawsuit on grounds that two such testers had no standing to sue because they didn't want the job for which they applied. The appeals court said testers have standing to sue under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the provision that outlaws hiring discrimination based on race. A man imprisoned on a rape conviction in Kentucky 7 years ago was freed based on new DNA testing. Jefferson Circuit Judge Barry Willett yesterday vacated William Gregory's 1993 convictions for rape and attempted rape and ordered a new trial for the one-time Sears salesman. Gregory became the first person in Kentucky released from prison based on new DNA evidence. And this news from Dearborn, Michigan. Thousands of protesters led by the Reverend Al Sharpton rallied yesterday outside a department store where a black man suffocated while security guards held him in a chokehold. About 10,000 people chanting, "No justice, no profits, no justice, no peace," gathered in a parking lot outside the Lord & Taylor store in this Detroit suburb, according to police estimates. The doors near the spot where Frederick Finley died were blocked by police barricades. No charges have been filed in the June 22nd death of the 32-year-old who was in the store with friends and family when surveillance cameras allegedly recorded some members of the group shoplifting. Security guards followed the group to the parking lot and tried to detain Finley's stepdaughter and a family friend, said police. Finley punched one of the guards before he was put in the chokehold, according to the police. The case has caught the attention of the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. The ACLU routinely fields complaints by minority shoppers who say they were subjected to unreasonable force and detention in area stores simply because of their race. A study paid for by the coal industry says minorities would suffer if the United States adopts a treaty to cut greenhouse gases. The study says more than 1 million Black and Hispanic Americans would lose their jobs if the United States treaty is adopted. Following up on a story we did yesterday, the European Parliament voted late yesterday to form a committee to investigate allegations the United States and allies like Britain use Cold War satellites to conduct industrial espionage in Europe. The U.S. Echelon spy system of satellites and listening posts can intercept millions of telephone, fax, and email messages, and Washington has been accused of using it for economic espionage against its allies. The United States and Britain have both denied the charges. And the Reverend Jesse Jackson said yesterday he'll lead a two-day march in Mississippi this weekend to draw attention to what he called the mysterious hanging deaths of Black men in the once deeply segregated southern state. Nach kmohu nach truer lehten huru nach kmohu huru vim bahan pe kohle i shall ku kuru vim bahan pe. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. British Army troops were rushed into Northern Ireland's capital, Belfast, late last night after a fourth day of widespread violence triggered by a ban on a Protestant march through a Roman Catholic enclave. This follows Northern Ireland's police chief, Sir Ronnie Flanagan, warning that pro-British Protestant loyalists were planning to launch gun and bomb attacks on his officers. Though British troops in Northern Ireland's police force are playing the role of peacekeepers, the most serious acts of violence are in fact being carried out by pro-British factions. The violence of the past 4 days has seen 9 British officers injured after they came under attack from rioters hurling stones, fireworks, and acid. There have been skirmishes where gas bombs were thrown at police. On several occasions, security forces exchanged fire with gunmen in loyalist North Belfast. In addition to the regular members of the Orange Order, there's an increased presence of pro-British paramilitaries in the streets. At several points, masked gunmen have fired on buildings and blockaded roads. The violence began on Monday after the Independent Northern Ireland Parades Commission banned the Drumcree March. Before that decision, Orangemen had promised a week of demonstrations leading up to the march. Political leaders on all sides of the political spectrum are predicting the situation will only continue to deteriorate over the next few days. Brendan McKenna now joins us. He's head of the Residents of Garbahi Road Coalition, a former political prisoner just arrested earlier this week. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Brendan McKenna. Can you tell us what the latest is?
Well, I suspect it's basically 2 p.m. here in Portadown. The situation at present is fairly quiet. However, we expect that to change in several hours' time as loyalists again congregate at the church at Drumcree and at a number of other flashpoint areas around the fringes of the nationalist community in Portadown in an attempt to try and force this march through the area.
Can you give us the context for all of this? For people who don't follow politics in the north of Ireland, how is this happening?
Well, I suppose from an American viewpoint, the closest analogy that one can make to the situation we find ourselves in Portadown, and indeed communities like myself and other parts of the north find themselves in relation to these Orange marches by the Orange Order, would be to draw the analogy on, say, the likes of the Ku Klux Klan, a white supremacist organization seeking to march through an entirely black township or town or suburb in some place in America. The Orange Order is primarily pro-British. It's primarily unionist and loyalist. It has an oath of membership, which all its members have to take. It stipulates that its members must be born of Protestant parentage, born in wedlock, must not be married to a Catholic, must not give succor or countenance to anyone of the Catholic faith. And if people can cast their minds back 70 years ago, they will realize that the Nazi Party in Germany had similar qualifications for membership, and that people who joined the Nazi Party had to be born of Aryan parents, could not have been married to Jews or have Jewish parents, and should not give succor or countenance to anyone from the Jewish faith. So in many respects, the Orange Order would be the Northern Ireland version of the Klan or of the Nazis. Simply, they are a supremacist unionist grouping which seeks to exert superiority over the Catholic nationalist minority. And as well as that, this grouping, this organisation, is also totally opposed to the Good Friday Agreement signed by both governments and most of the political parties in the north of Ireland 2 years ago. The agreement which almost 90% of the people, well over 90% of the people on the island of Ireland voted in favour of, in an attempt to bring about a situation throughout the whole of Ireland where we could start working towards building a society based on equality and justice. And quite clearly the Orange Order, by their actions over the last number of years, their active campaigning against the Good Friday Agreement, are clearly opposed to any notion which would see equality of treatment for the Catholic and nationalist minority in the north of Ireland.
We're talking to Brendan McKenna, who is in Portadown now in the north of Ireland, head of the residents of the Garvaghy Road Coalition. You were arrested earlier this week. What happened?
Well, I was arrested on Saturday morning by the RUC, the police force which we have in the north of Ireland, which is primarily recruited from the unionist community. Almost 93% of its membership would be drawn from the unionist community. Loyalists had gathered at the bottom end of Garvaghy Road on Saturday morning from the early hours. The RUC had moved in. They had almost immediately arrested several local people, local nationalists. And in my role as an elected representative, I had been contacted by a number of people living in the area to go to the scene and attempt to calm it down.
Adam?
I spoke to a number of nationalists who were at the scene to try and ascertain what had happened, and then went and spoke to an RUC inspector. I asked him what has happened to young people, why had they been arrested, were they going to be charged, how long were they going to be detained. He refused to answer any questions. I then told him that I was going to go across further down the road and speak to where there was another group of nationalists gathered in a very agitated manner. The people were obviously, you know, annoyed and agitated about the arrests. I said, look, I'm just here to try and calm the situation down. He still never spoke. As I proceeded to go to towards that other group of nationalists, local Catholics, an RUC armoured Land Rover pulled in on the road beside me. Several members of the RUC got out, told me that I was under arrest, and then transported me 5 miles away to a police station in Lurgan, where I was then charged with several counts of assault, disorderly behaviour likely to lead to a breach of the peace, and then released. Now, my own opinion as regards what happened Saturday was yet another example that at a time when there was a need for calm on the streets, especially in Portadown, and when I was there to actively try and ensure that there was no reaction from nationalists on the streets in Portadown, the RUC deliberately tried to heighten the tension and create a confrontation by arresting myself.
Eileen Clancy is also joining us from Portadown. She's a member of the Irish Parade's Emergency Committee, a delegation of international observers in Portadown, which is monitoring security forces and documenting incidents. How does this situation this year, Eileen Clancy, compare to the last four marches that you've observed?
Well, I think what we're seeing is basically the Orange Order, after being relatively calm last year in the hopes that they could get their way and get these marches that they're so attached to, into the Catholic communities. That didn't work out for them, and what's happened now is that there's been open presence of loyalist paramilitaries who were theoretically on ceasefire and out of jail on that basis, where they've been shown on television shooting guns off in public and threatening no surrender and that type of thing. So what's happening is, it appears, over the last several days, is that there's been what you'd say a coordinated and what appears to be orchestrated campaign of intimidation and harassment that's been going on in a number of different communities in Northern Ireland. And it appears that their hope is if they cause enough trouble, this has worked for them in previous years on different occasions, especially in 1996, where they shut down the entire six counties, they shut down the transportation system and the ports and the roads, that basically the police then either give in or are given the pretext that they must comply with their demands because they've sort of they have the bigger stick and they've been able to immobilize the place. What you have now is the Irish News headline this morning is Army back on streets as city is paralyzed. For the first time in about 2 years, British troops returned to the streets of Belfast to try to keep order. So it's a pretty menacing situation. In being in, I'm in Portadown in the Nationalist side of the Gravahi Road, and I've been here a number of days. And we're seeing things such as, you know, sort of young bands of loyalists, you know, perhaps with thuggish intent, running around with their faces covered and harassing the security forces. And petrol bombs have been thrown, which are gasoline bombs or Molotov cocktails, and something called blast bombs, which I believe have little bits of shrapnel in them and are quite dangerous and can kill people. So those have been thrown over fencing into the Catholic nationalist areas. And the folks here are very, very concerned about what's going to happen on this weekend because this march, there are going to be marches every night this week, and even though they're not getting routed through the Catholic areas, they're very concerned that what's going to happen is what's happened in 96 and in prior years, where in fact there's been murders. So that's a major concern for people here.
And a side note, the violence has also brought the return of British General Michael Jackson to the north of Ireland. He's one of the leaders of NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia, also a key player in the bloody Sunday massacre decades ago when British forces opened fire on Catholic protesters. I want to bring Eamon McCann into this conversation, an independent journalist based in Derry, also in British-occupied north of Ireland, leader of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Can you put the Orange Men and the marches this week in the broader context of the British occupation?
Well, the Orange Order, of course, was founded more than 200 years ago with the explicit intention of supplying the organizational structure and the ideology which would keep the Protestant community separate from the Catholic community and maintain the Protestant community as a sort of defense force or a defense community for maintaining British rule in Northern Ireland. Those people listening who know a bit about Irish history will know that the Orange Order was founded just 3-4 years after the United Irish Men were founded, and that was an organization which was dedicated to bringing Catholics and Protestants together in a project for uniting Ireland as an independent nation. The United Irish Men was led by Presbyterians and members of the Church of Ireland like Wolfe Tone. And because the Orange Order was set up 4 years later precisely to counter that tendency. These things may seem, and indeed in one sense are, buried deep in our history, but the immediate direct relevance of them in the year 2000 can be seen on the streets of Portadown and Belfast even as we speak. The specific function of the Orange Order in ideological terms is to make an equation between the Protestant religion and pro-British unionist politics, and that means that to give an inch to nationalists, to make any compromise at all politically, can be presented as a blasphemy as going against God. And in this way, the religious element, which Brendan McKenna referred to in the Orange Order's makeup, becomes a force for absolute sectarian intransigence in the politics of Northern Ireland at the moment. So that's what we're dealing with historically.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Eamon McCann, independent journalist based in Derry in British-occupied Northern Ireland. Brendan McKenna, head of the residence of the Gurbhagi Road Coalition, will certainly continue to follow what happens over these next few days. And Eileen Clancy of the Irish Parades Emergency Committee. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, the first civil union in the United States. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Under a quilt of stars, as friends and family blew bubbles and kisses into the warm night air, Kathleen Peterson and Carolyn Conrad exchanged vows of love and commitment this past weekend and became the first same-sex couple in the nation to be recognized as civil union partners under Vermont's far-reaching law, which took effect on July 1st. Just before she left for work this morning, I got a chance to talk to Kathleen Peterson. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So how did it feel?
It was wonderful. I think probably the neatest part about it, aside from the fact that it was actually happening, was that we had lots of folks around and folks that we didn't know who just came to show support and tell us what they thought about what we were doing, and it was really neat.
Can you describe the ceremony?
Oh, it was pretty simple. We wrote up a few words for each other to kind of describe how we feel about each other. And the Justice of the Peace did kind of a conglomeration of three or four different kinds of ceremonies that my partner had put together. And at the end, we were joined. It was simple. I mean, it felt like it was elegant.
Why did you want to be the first?
Well, it kind of started out as a goof. We had a friend who, when we told her we were going to get civil unionized on the first day, she said, well, aren't you going to do it at midnight? And I thought, well, it would be kind of cool to do it at midnight. So we started talking about it because it was a big deal. We were really hoping that the Freedom to Marry Task Force or someone who had really worked hard for this would be first, and that it'd be something in process. So we didn't really know if it was going to happen originally. And we found out that there really wasn't anything else going on, so we went for it.
How did it come to be that Vermont is the first state in the country to allow civil unions?
Wow, Vermont to be the first state, Vermont's pretty unique. Vermonters, although they may be opposed to something, have a way to express their opinions, get their point across, and still be neighbors with the person that you disagree with. It feels to me as if Vermonters take care of themselves, they take care of each other. And that's what it felt as if the legislature was doing, was that they were taking care of a piece of the population that hadn't been taken care of before and needed to be put on, I can't say an absolutely equal footing, but definitely a better footing than they had been in the past. They chose what was right. You're just denying someone civil liberties, and by the Constitution, that's wrong. So they chose what was right. They voted with their hearts and their conscience. They heard both sides of the story quite loudly. They spent a couple of nights sitting in the State House listening to arguments for pro and con, and chose in the end that pro was the way to go.
I understand some town clerks resigned rather than give out licenses for civil unions. Can you tell us about the town clerk who married you or civil unionized you?
The town clerk who helped us out and gave us our certificate, is an absolutely wonderful woman. I called her, asked her if it was possible to get our paperwork, because we were thinking of doing this on July 1st, this originally. We were just going to have a ceremony during the day before the midnight thing came up. And she told me that there shouldn't be any problem getting paperwork, but she was going to a seminar, and she'd let me know more about it. I should call back in a couple of weeks. And I called back in a couple of weeks, and she said, I think that's not going to happen. From the seminar, she learned that they couldn't even sign the paperwork, the town clerks, because it was a legal document for the state of Vermont until July 1st. And I hemmed and hawed a little bit on the phone, and I said, well, listen, this is what we're thinking about doing. We'd like to do our ceremony at midnight. Is there any way possible for me to pick the paperwork up the day before, even without you having your signature on it? And she said to me on the phone, well, why don't you let me think about that midnight thing and call me back in a couple hours. So I called her back in 2 or 3 hours. She said that she had called her husband. He said he was really, really proud of her. And could you bring him? And I had already invited her to the ceremony, and I had a resounding yes, please bring him. And she agreed to meet us at the town hall at midnight. Yeah, now you have to understand that I didn't know Annette before this happened at all. She just believed in civil union and the civil rights that were being given, and really went out of her way for us. And as she said in one of the interviews, and we very much consider her and her husband to be friends, and I didn't even know her 2 weeks ago. So it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kathleen Peterson, who was the first person to join in civil union with her partner, Carolyn Conrad, on July 1st in Vermont, the first state to allow civil unions. What is the difference between civil union and marriage for you?
For us, it's pretty legal. We own a house, so we can, according to our lawyer, change our mortgage over to in totem. We also take care of each other. I mean, we have joint checking accounts and all that stuff. So there are rights of survivorship for that stuff and the house. And there's an insurance benefit from the state, well, within the state, that by January 1st, 2000, there will be, I will have the ability to put my partner on my insurance and she to put me on hers. For us, it's not a necessity right now. It will be a great benefit if either of us ends up without insurance at some point. And that I know that there are people out there who need to take care of each other, and this will help.
Were there people at your ceremony who you didn't even know?
Probably 50 to 75 people at our ceremony that we didn't even know. And I kind of include the press in that. We had met a couple of the press people, or at least spoken to them on the phone. But I spoke to a young man who had brought his fiancée with him, and he said he'd been hanging out at McNeil's, which is one of the local pubs. He said, "We heard that there were going to be people who opposed this down here, so we came down in support." And they grabbed a bunch of folks from the pub and came down and cheered and smiled and gave us their blessing. It was neat.
Were there people who were opposed that showed up?
Yes. There was a group of young folks from a church in Rutland, Vermont. They came. They were civil, quiet, didn't disturb the ceremony. They held their signs. They said their piece, and they were very respectful to us as people, even though the views that they expressed were not our views, and our views were not theirs.
How did that make you feel?
Pretty good. It's a wonderful thing to be able to, you know, even stand across the street from somebody who is vehemently opposing your views and not worry that violence is going to happen or words will be thrown. It was, it's part of what the United States is about, right? It's, you're supposed to be able to express your views. And they did, and we did, and it was sane, and it was good.
And finally, because I know you have to go to work, how does it change your relationship?
Oh, not a whole lot. we've been together for 5 years. We're pretty happy. We are maybe a little less stressed on a daily basis that if something happens to either one of us, that we can make our own decisions without having to worry about somebody stepping in.
Well, Kathleen Peterson, thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Kathleen Peterson, she and Carolyn Conrad engaged in the first civil union ceremony in the United States in Vermont at midnight on July 1st. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the first lesbians in the nation to be legally, as she put it, civilly unionized. We're going to talk about the national implications for this with Evan Wolfson, director of the Marriage Project at Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, who is leader of the nationwide movement for gays and lesbians to be able to marry. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Evan
Thank
Wolfson.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also just coming in the last few weeks from the Supreme Court with the defeat on the issue of Boy Scouts and gays and gay men, I guess, and lesbians. I don't know if there are women Boy Scout leaders, but not being allowed, or the Boy Scouts being allowed to discriminate against them. But on this issue of civil marriage, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think there is a very important personal choice that people make in their lives about taking on the commitment and responsibilities of marriage, and obviously it's a personal choice that matters a great deal to the real-life couple involved and their loved ones. But it's also a very important hallmark of citizenship and equality. And being denied the freedom to marry harms real-life families in concrete ways, and also by labeling their committed love, their relationship, as not worthy of respect under the law. In most states today, lesbians and gay men, no matter how long we've been together with our partners, no matter how committed our relationships, no matter how much we need the protections that come with marriage, and they are vast, we're treated under the law as no more than roommates, as strangers to each other. And that really is wrong, and it has to stop. And Vermont now has taken a tremendous step toward equality by creating not marriage, but gay marriage, a separate status that is a legal marital status under state law to allow people to take on this important legal commitment and the responsibilities and protections that come with it. It's not good enough, because what we want is not gay marriage, but marriage. But it is a wonderful example to the rest of the country that the sky won't fall when lesbians and gay men are able to say, I do.
We're also joined by journalist David Goodman, who did a piece in the July-August issue of Mother Jones called A More Civil Union. David's a Vermont writer. Why Vermont, David? Why do you think it happened there?
One of the most important things that happened here, in addition to all the nice neighborliness stuff that Kathleen mentioned, and I don't discount that, was something quite practical, and that is Vermonters in a variety of ways shut down the flow of money and the voices coming from the national religious right. And that is crucial in a key respect, because in March, the national religious right showed how powerful it was in California, spending $10 million to pass an anti-gay marriage bill known as the Knight Initiative. So, and also in Hawaii and Alaska, where courts had varying ways were moving to legalize gay marriage. Millions of dollars were dumped on those states in the last couple of years, resulting in constitutional amendments being passed banning gay marriage. So along comes Vermont, a state of 600,000, and clearly not does not have the financial wherewithal to go up against this machine. And I saw two things happen in covering this. One was at the State House. Political leaders announced that no one but Vermonters would be allowed to speak to this issue inside the halls of the State House. So all of a sudden, a guy like Randall Terry, who people know as the fanatical anti-abortion leader who had moved to Vermont to fight civil unions, was reduced to shouting himself hoarse on the snow-covered steps of the State House outside, but having no forum inside. Financially, what it meant was that even the people trying to stop civil unions had to announce publicly that they would not take out-of-state money. And this has meant that a total of about $500,000 was spent by both sides on this issue, which, as you know, I mean, that's a pittance by national political standards. So something happened here that didn't happen anywhere else in the country, and that was that gay rights was debated on its merits. And when that happened, I saw at town meetings and at public hearings around the state, gay men and lesbians speaking to their neighbors. And suddenly, instead of things being referred to as the national homosexual agenda, as the religious right was referring to this, it was just neighbors talking to neighbors. And the ability to demonize gay neighbors fell away. And it was probably, what it meant was simply that this became not only an issue of human rights, but more practically, it was an issue of neighbor rights. And that was a pretty hard issue for the anti-gay forces to beat.
Evan Wolfson.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, and certainly the point about the overwhelming right-wing attack on equal rights in California and Hawaii and Alaska to try to thwart our advances toward marriage in those states temporarily. But I do want to make two other points about Vermont. One is that, of course, the battle is not over. There's an election coming up in November, and right-wing forces have targeted legislators in Vermont who supported equality and civil rights for defeat. And so it is important that people work with the leaders and community folk in Vermont to support the politicians who had the courage to do the right thing. And the other important reason why Vermont took this step forward is that prior to our even bringing the court case through the Vermont lawyers and the gay and lesbian advocates and defenders in New England, who were the co-counsel on the case, prior to launching the legal case that precipitated the legislative need to address the constitutional command of equality, there was a task force formed of Vermont people, gay and non-gay people, who worked for 2 years to lay a foundation of reaching out to non-gay neighbors, non-gay groups, non-gay church groups, non-gay press, non-gay legislators, to educate them about how the denial of marriage harms gay people. So in other words, even before we pushed forward legally and even before we pushed forward into the legislature, resulting in this terrific new law, There was 2 years of serious engagement of hearts and minds with non-gay people, group to group, person to person. That's a very important foundation that we now need to lay in every state. Courts are not going to just hand us our equality. Legislators are certainly not going to just turn around and hand us equality one day. We need to engage by asking non-gay people and community leaders to understand this, to learn about it, and to feel comfortable with it, and to speak out. And if we don't ask, they're not going to do it.
What about the next state? Is there a next state battleground you see?
Well, I think this battleground has to take place in every state. In all 50 states, we're denied the freedom to marry, including Vermont. We're not finished in Vermont. And certainly Vermont and Hawaii are the two states that have gone the furthest right now toward creating a legal protection for gay couples. The reason we have gone as far as we've gone in Vermont and Hawaii is because we brought these court cases in Hawaii and Vermont, and because we battled in the legislature year after year after year. That same kind of battling has to take place in all 50 states. And the foundation that must be laid is this task force work of asking for support, neighbor to neighbor, group to group, person to person. So as lawyers, we at Lambda, together with GLAAD and the ACLU and others, are certainly looking at where do we think we might be able to bring a useful legal challenge, a carefully mounted legal case. But legal cases have to rest on this engagement that has to happen in all 50 states. And we look forward to working with activists, gay and non-gay, who believe in civil rights in all 50 states starting now. There's no reason to be waiting for some court somewhere to do it. And we definitely don't want to leave Vermont hanging out there as the only place that has taken this large step toward equality. We don't want to leave them out there alone. It's important that we begin this work in all 50 states.
If people want to get in touch with the national movement, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund serves as the clearinghouse for the National Freedom to Marry Coalition and for all the other legal and political groups who are working on this civil rights cause. And a good place to start is by going to the website, which is www.lambdalegal.org. So that's www.lambdalegal.org.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Evan Wolfson, who is the leader of this movement nationally for gays and lesbians to be able to marry. Evan Wolfson, the director of the Marriage Project at Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, and David Goodman speaking to us from Vermont, wrote the piece in this month's Mother Jones that has just come out on gay marriage called A More Civil Union. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, the nation's oldest continuously publishing newspaper apologizes for its role in slavery. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Finally, we're going to revisit the issue of slavery and who profited from it. Over the past several months, Democracy Now! Has covered the issue of reparations to African Americans. We've looked at the Dwolfs of Rhode Island, the biggest slaveholding family in the Northeast, and we've reported on the Aetna Insurance Company and the apology they made this year for insuring slave holders in case their slaves died or ran away, but saying that they would not give reparations in any other way. Well, on July 4th, just this past Tuesday, the Hartford Courant ran a front-page story admitting its own complicity in the slave trade. The Connecticut paper acknowledged that in the 1700s and 1800s, it published ads for the sale of slaves and recapture of runaways. And current publishers, including Thomas Green, who founded the paper in 1764, acted as slave brokers. The newspaper, which is the nation's longest continuously published daily, said it felt compelled to apologize for its role in that chapter of all of our histories. We're joined on the phone now by Lou Golden, who is deputy publisher of the Hartford Courant. What brought you to this point?
Well, I think it's a natural evolution. When we look at our role, it's very easy to see that it was wrong. And once you see that it was wrong, it's very easy to say, oh, we're sorry that happened.
Now, you had done a piece, the newspaper, Hartford Courant, on Aetna. Is that right?
Yes.
And so how did that take you to your own admission?
Well, the editors here, after we ran that story, the editors decided we should take a look at ourselves and see what kind of role the Courant played. And as part of that research, they discovered that indeed we ran ads listing runaway slaves and ads of slaves for sale. And as part of that, the management here was asked, are we going to apologize? And, that was the natural evolution of it. We apologized.
What kind of response have you gotten in these last 2 days?
It's been very interesting. I think you could say that any time you take a stand on anything, you're going to get a response. And we're getting a lot of pro and a lot of negative. And it shouldn't surprise anybody. The African-American community is split here. There are people who are applauding us, and there are folks in the African-American community who are using this as an opportunity to talk about the fact that they don't like our coverage of that community here in this area. There are others who think we're covering that community great and also applaud us for the stand we're taking.
I'm looking at a piece in the New York Times today on your apology at the Hartford Courant, and they say that the New York Times was founded in 1851 after slavery was outlawed in New York State, and that a spokesperson for the Times says the paper did not believe that it had run ads for the sale or capture of slaves, but that other newspapers have published or are preparing to publish articles on their complicity in the slave trade. The forerunner of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, a newspaper called the Daily Picayune, also ran advertisements seeking to sell slaves or to find runaways. A fact, paper noted in a long article in 1993. We're also joined on the telephone by Professor Ira Berlin, who is a historian at the University of Maryland and author of Many Thousands Gone, The First Two Centuries of Slavery in North America. How unusual is the Hartford Courant, Professor Berlin?
Well, I think they're unusual in what they've done here at the beginning of the 21st century. They're not unusual in what they were doing in the 18th century. America was a slave society, and slavery was an intimate part of the economy, of politics, of life. So it's not surprising that slaves, like other commodities, would be advertised in a newspaper. I would say in the 18th century is probably ubiquitous. Mm-hmm.
What kind of information can you gather about slavery from these newspaper ads, and how have you, as a historian, used them?
Well, as it turns out, these newspaper ads are one of the most important sources we have for understanding black life during slavery. When slaves ran away or they were sold, their owners gave various information about them. Obviously, they were trying to be as accurate as possible, so we have a case where the very function of the genre gives it a prima facie kind of accuracy, and we learn all kinds of things about people, the kinds of clothes they wear, their stature, how they fix their hair, their skills, where they might run away to, their nationality, their family life, and a variety of things come out of these advertisements for sale and for flight.
You know, we have been looking at the issue of slavery, obviously, quite extensively. And a few months ago, we had Deidre Farmer Pellman on, who is a law student, New York activist, who was the person who started asking Aetna about its policies to ensure slave holders. Deidre Farmer Pellman, it looks like this was what sparked the Hartford Courant to look at itself after it did an article on Aetna. What are your thoughts today?
Yeah, no, I think it's wonderful that that they have sort of followed the trend that I had hoped would occur. I think that their mission is further proof to all Americans that slavery was not just profitable for Southern planters, but that it basically was something that supported the whole American economy, even when it was illegal in the North. And I think the admission helps all Americans to know that many of the direct beneficiaries of slavery are still alive and are still in a position, a financial position, where they can pay restitution for their crimes against humanity. And I would hope that in addition to their admission, that the Hartford Courant will consider paying restitution in some form for their role in supporting slavery.
Lou Golden, deputy publisher of the Hartford Courant, what about that?
Well, that's obviously something that we have to think about. We haven't gotten to that point yet.
What would it mean? What, Deidre Farmer Pellman, do you think reparations would look like?
Well, I mean, it depends on what the company can do. I hear that there are community folks who are concerned about the policies of the Hartford Courant and coverage of African Americans. It could be increased advertising from certain companies that may not necessarily have the access to advertise. It could be scholarship funds. It could be improving diversity, if that's an issue. I haven't really researched the Hartford Courant. It could be paying into a trust fund. In fact, I'm in the process of setting up a trust fund. There's a major organization that has come forward to hold trust fund monies for restitution from corporations. There's so many different ways that a company can pay restitution to the descendants of slaves.
Mr. Golden, are these ideas that have been thrown around at the Hartford Courant at this point, as you apologize officially on the front page of your paper for involvement in slavery by advertising for runaway slaves and making money off of slavery?
I have to say that these are things that that we will consider. I think we're very proud of our track record here in being responsive to all communities and trying to be responsive in our coverage and trying to be responsive as a community citizen. One of the programs that we support that does the most good for the city of Hartford is a camp called Camp Current, which is a free day camp for any child who lives in the city of Hartford. The city is a poor city in many ways, and we have served more than 1,000 kids a day free. And that is one program of many that we have launched to serve this community. It is the largest free day camp in the country.
In the article in the New York Times, talking about the different newspapers that have been involved in slave era ads, it says there's a website, www.afrigenas, that's AFRIGENEAS.com, that lists runaway slave ads from the newspapers that regularly publish them, including the Baltimore Sun. On September 17th, 1852, for instance, the Sun ran an ad offering a $100 reward for, quote, a Negro boy named George Stewart, a slave for life. Ira Berlin is a professor of history at the University of Maryland with your specialty in slavery. What about this issue of reparations as corporations today are beginning to be confronted by those deeply concerned about slavery or doing their own research and beginning to sort of come clean with what their involvement was, whether it was an insurance company or a newspaper like the Hartford Courant?
Well, I mean, obviously this is part of a coming to terms with our past as a people, and I think the people at the Hartford Courant, Mr. Golden, should be congratulated for doing his part and the paper doing their part. But I would point out that the involvement in slavery goes beyond a single institution or newspaper. It very much speaks to our history as a people more generally. That is, for most of our history, we were a slave society, and slavery thus touched all aspects of American life. We can say that the New York Times did not advertise for a runaway slaves, and slavery had ended, although just barely, in the state of New York. But they certainly advertised for slave-grown goods, cotton, textiles, and so on. So they're just a step away from doing what the Hartford Courant is doing in advertising for runaway slaves or selling slaves directly. So I think it's up to us as a people to confront our past more generally. And although there are specific instances in which we can say a particular institution or a particular individual fortune is based upon and has its origin in the institution of slavery, I think perhaps the most important thing for us to understand is how much of our own origins, most generally as a people, are connected to slavery, and that's something which we have to deal with collectively, just as we celebrate American independence and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and all of the things we're very proud of. There are some things in our past which we're not particularly proud of.
May I add to that?
Lou Golden, last word, deputy publisher of the Hartford Courant.
I think what we did in apologizing is very consistent with what we've asked Congress to do. We ran an editorial 3 years ago calling upon Congress to acknowledge its part in this dreadful act of slavery and to apologize. And what we did is really no less than what we asked the government to do.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Ira Berlin, professor of history, University of Maryland, Lou Golden, deputy publisher of the Hartford Courant, and Deidrea Farmer-Pillman, who is one of those who started this latest wave of dealing with companies and all of our legacy of slavery in this country, as she started to investigate the Aetna Insurance Company and its involvement in profiting off of slavery. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of this program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Nell Geiser also helped. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this is Radio Nation, a progressive review of news, politics, and culture.